Music's Lessons for Life.
So music and the band, the concept of a band, and what you said, the biggest thing ingredient, listening. It's the biggest thing right there. Music shows you that clearly. So a lot of the times when I'm really teaching and talking about life, I just call it music.
That's Victor Wooten, co-founder of the band Bella Fleck and the Flecktones, and author of The Spirit of Music. It's an inspiring parable of the importance of music and the threat that it faces in today's world. Then we talk with historian David Steben about his book, Promised Land, How the Rise of the Middle Class Transformed America. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice, in-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We may not realize it as we listen to the soundtrack of our lives through tiny earbuds, but music is disappearing all around us. Bass guitarist Victor Wooten is a 5-time Grammy winner, founding member of Bella Fleck and the Flecktones, and a music teacher. So when he says the spirit of music is endangered, it pays us to listen. In his allegorical fable, The Spirit of Music, three musicians from around the world are mysteriously summoned to Nashville, Tennessee, to join Victor in doing battle against the mysterious phasers, whose blinking music-canceling headphones silence and destroy all musical sound. Only by coming together and making the joyful sounds of live music can the spirit of music be restored to the world. Victor Wooten is the author of several books, including The Music Lesson, A Spiritual Search for Growth Through Music. Well, Victor Wooten, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Now, you were a founding member of Bella Fleck and the Flecktones, and your thesis in this book, The Spirit of Music, is that music is dying. So first I'm going to ask you what you mean by that, then I'll ask you something about Bella Fleck and the Flecktones.
Well, it's a thought and a concept that may have some truth to it. If you think of the fact that when we were younger, the way we heard music, if we didn't go hear it live, the way we heard music was on vinyl. And then in the 80s, late 80s, mid 80s, late 80s, it turned into CDs. And, you know, a CD is made up of waveforms, which is different than an analog file that vinyl uses. So we've gotten smaller with CD. And now the current standard for, like, my kids is MP3. And MP3 is about the tenth the size of a waveform that makes up a CD, which is even smaller than what the files that makes up vinyl. And, of course, all of it is smaller than hearing it live. But our kids are growing up thinking that an MP3 is normal, and then they listen to it through tiny earbuds or a computer speaker or a phone speaker, which squashes it even more. So we're not receiving music in its entirety the way we used to as the norm. It's also caused us to listen to this music as a solo experience. We put on our headphones and listen not to a whole album of an artist, but we choose the songs we want to listen to, and we listen to them out of order. And we think we've heard that whole artist. That's the basis of it. You know, so the thought that music is dying is based off of that, I guess.
What does it mean when you get used to listening to music that has only, as you say, like one-tenth the musical information in it? What does that do to our brains? What does that do to our relationship to music?
Well, I am no expert, but I have been in touch with a lot of people who are considered experts. And there have been many studies on this, actually. And there's been quite a few studies that show that kids who learn music as a young child grow up better off. You know, they know how to communicate better. They know when to listen. They socialize easier. And they're actually smarter. It actually helps them with the normal academics. And so it's a powerful thing. But if we think about like someone like me that's in the music business, I'll put it this way. When we were young, television was free and we paid for our music. Totally reversed these days. We expected music to be free, but I'm happy to pay for television and then complain that there's nothing to watch. So that's part of it. And I could go on for the next, you know, hour or so and give you more things. But again, if you think about it, music as a whole has become mostly an individual endeavor. We listen to music alone, where it used to be if we bought a record, we got together in a group or a family and we listened to both sides of it, as well as we read everything on the album credits. So it's just a different mentality these days. And, you know, I could go into the fact that also we're not receiving all the pitches. Everything is compressed. Everything is pitch corrected, rhythm corrected. So we're not getting all of music, period. And then when we squash it, it's less. And there have been studies on the effect of it, literally on how it affects us as well as our brains and our societies.
And you do explore that more in the early pages in this book, Victor Wooten, in The Spirit of Music. But as you say, there's really a lot more to it. And I guess one question that I had is this linked to a kind of commercialization of music, a kind of industrialization, if you will, like industrial industry is to agriculture, industry is also to music. And I was going to ask you whether your experience in the Flecktones, you know, what did it teach you about this process?
Well, I think one of the things that working with Bela, it helped me realize, and this may sound a little egotistical, but it helped me realize that good music and real music still has a place in society. So we were an instrumental band led by a banjo player. You know, I'm playing this bass in the weirdest way. The original version of the band had a harmonica player, and then my brother playing a weird drum that looked like, you know, it was more from outer space than anything else. But people loved it. We did the Johnny Carson show 3 times, Jay Leno twice, Arsenio Hall. You know, we toured and it's like, wow, music still has a place. It doesn't have to be watered down. What most of us think of commercialization, we think that it has, whatever's commercial has to be diminished in quality to become commercial. And that's not true. In my mind, commercial means popular, means everybody likes it and can access it easily. When I was young, music was that way. Pop music just meant popular. And so we'd have jazz stations that played jazz, rock stations, R&B, but the pop stations played it all just because it was popular. So you'd hear Aretha Franklin next to Elvis, next to the Beatles, next to James Brown. And it was popular. That was commercial music, but it wasn't diminished at all. So nowadays, commercial has taken on a different quality. And I look at, and I don't want to sound negative. I definitely don't want to sound like the old guy that talks about how it used to be in my day. But I do recognize a real problem where, you know, these days, the music, we're substituting quality with technology. In other words, you don't have to be a good singer. I've got enough technology to make you sound like one. Where it used to be, the key to becoming famous was to be good. That's all it was. You didn't have to dress with, you know, showing a lot of skin. You didn't have to have orange hair. You just had to sing well or play well. And that was the criteria. Nowadays, it's totally different. And I'm not here to totally say that it's worse, but I am trying to raise the awareness to the problem, not only in our ears and our music, but to society that this diminishing music may be causing.
Right. And, you know, used to be you had to be a really good drummer. Now you can just lay down a drum track, just insert one.
Right. And believe it or not, Francesca, that's true for any instrument. You don't have to be a good bass player, a good piano player, a good singer. We can fix it. Like the joke is we can fix it in the mix.
Now, to this book, because it's really a passion. I would say it's an allegory. You know, when I first started out reading it, I thought, oh, this is a memoir. This is like a philosophical memoir. But it really very quickly turned into a kind of rollicking plot of what I could only see as an allegory more than a memoir. I wonder if you could say more just about what is this book?
I usually explain to people, I start with, this is fiction. I say the lessons are real, but the story may not be. I look at this book as if going to watch Star Wars or Avatar or Cinderella or anything. There's real lessons there. But we don't have to argue over whether Yoda's real or whether Luke is really Darth Vader's son, right? We just enjoy the story if we choose. But the lessons, if you really listen to what they're saying, right? They say, may the force be with me, may be with you. But you can substitute the word force for anything and realize the power in it. So I wanted to write a story that way, that it's not so much that it's true, because that releases me from having to defend it. And I can say, no, I didn't say that. The character, Michael, said that or whatever. But the people who want to receive the lessons, they are there. The people who just want to follow the story for entertainment, that's there also. So I kind of explain it as a fable, but I would rather go fiction than a life story, even though a lot of my life is in that book.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Victor Wooten about his book, The Spirit of Music. And that really does come through, and it comes through in the perspective. So music. In this book, music is dying. You speak with her. And you refer to her as her. First of all, why is music feminine?
Well, for quite a few reasons. And it doesn't mean that it is or isn't. It's just the way I portrayed it in the book. But anyone with that much patience, to me, is more of a female quality than male. The other thing that I learned from my brothers is that, let's look at it this way. If a politician says, everybody raise your hands in the air. Or if a police officer says, everybody raise your hands in the air. Or if a musician says, everybody raise your hands in the air. Who's going to be able to get more people to do it? The musician, without question. But check it out. The musician gets you to do it on your own will. Right? Right? You do it by choice, happily. My brothers call that feminine power. It's done without force. And music has that power of bringing people together, right? Everyone who's at your concert are your cheerleaders. They're not there if they don't love you. It's not like sports where half the people are against you. When you play music, people forget their problems. When I'm standing next to you at the concert, I don't care who you voted for, who you pray to, how much money you make, or the color of your skin. Music erases that. It makes you forget all your problems. And we all agree all of a sudden when music is playing. We just agree. That's feminine power because we do it on our own choice. When we play music, no one wins or loses, right? It's just about us. That's powerful. And I would say that's more feminine than masculine.
And it's also about listening as well as playing. And I'm not just talking about the audience listening to music, but musicians playing together have to really listen to each other.
Of course. Of course. And to even take that further, you're absolutely right. We have to listen to each other. We have to listen to our instruments. We agree before we play. We even tune and we just, you know, make sure we're in agreement first. In a band, the band is better when all the instruments are different, not the same. And we celebrate, we recognize and celebrate everybody's differences in a band. I don't try to make the bass player into a flute. I don't tell the drummer, hey, be more like the guitars. No, I want the drummer to be the drummer. I want the drummer to know who he or she is and do that. Bass player the same, singer the same. So we celebrate our differences. We recognize and celebrate. And we know that if we listen to each other, as a whole, we create a bigger, we have a bigger success. It's beautiful. It's the great analogy of how life should be lived, right? Rhythm, one more example. Rhythm will make things that don't make sense. I got this from my brother Joseph. Rhythm will make things that don't make sense make sense. For example, as my brother would say, if I cough and drop a chair, right? Those things don't have anything in common until I add rhythm. If I cough, cough, drop, cough, drop, and put rhythm to it, all of a sudden, those two non-related things make sense. Well, in life, instead of rhythm, it's called respect. My brother Joseph says, respect is the rhythm of life. So if we don't agree with each other, but you know that I respect your views, we can still be friends. It's when we lose respect that our disagreements take on a whole monstrous meaning. So music and the band, the concept of a band, and what you said, the biggest thing ingredient, listening. It's the biggest thing right there. Music shows you that clearly. So a lot of the times when I'm really teaching and talking about life, I just call it music, and then people accept it. It's not like religion or politics or anything like that. People still agree on music.
You know, I love what you're saying, and especially that phrase that you said, that respect is the rhythm of life. And it made me think of the incredible chaos and cacophony that's caused when people don't respect each other.
Exactly. Exactly. My brother calls respect cultural rhythm. It's what rhythm does in music that makes things relate and makes everybody come together. We all dance to the rhythm. Nobody dances to the key of the song, the note, which, like the melody, my brother said, is like the point you make in a conversation. But the point doesn't mean anything if there's not respect, if there's not rhythm. All right. So music is a powerful thing, which is why I hope we can, bring it back as a normal part of education.
As it used to be when I was a kid, but is no longer. You've talked a lot already about your brothers. You're the youngest of siblings in your family. Is that right?
That's right. The youngest of five boys.
And they were all musicians.
Yeah, it's very true. They knew I was the bass player even before I was born.
How did they know that?
Because Reggie, the oldest, was already playing guitar. Roy, next, was playing drums. Rudy, saxophone, and Joseph, keyboards. So they needed a bass player. True story.
That's great. Well, you have another story in the book, which is that when you were a child, a mysterious man appeared, apparently homeless, appeared at your door, and all of a sudden a small bass, manifested itself in his hand. Now, is that just a fable, or is there something true in that too?
Both. It's a fable, but that In my life, I would say that man who just happened to be there with an instrument was my family. It was my family. But a lot of people already know my family story, at least in the music world, that I'm the youngest of five. So to write that story, I'd rather write a different story. So I just came up with that to make the story more interesting. But it's really what happened to me. When I was born, I had these geniuses. And my oldest brother's only 8 years older than me. So he's the oldest one. He's the one that taught me. And my earliest memories of really learning with them and playing with them was when I was two. But Reggie, when I was two, was only 10. And he was teaching me bass, and he taught Joseph, who when I was two, Joseph was five. So Reggie, only being, 5 years older than Joseph, was teaching Joseph keyboards. So Reggie was 10, Roy was 9, Rudy was 8. By the time I was five, we were the opening band for a great soul singer named Curtis Mayfield during his Superfly era, because we were living in Sacramento. So we did gigs up the West Coast. And I tell people that, and people point the finger at me. Wow, you were only two, or you were only five. But the real story is Reggie, my oldest brother, right? How many 10-year-olds do you know have the patience, the know-how, the willpower, and the love, and the knowledge to teach their little brothers well enough to be on a major tour in a few short years. And he's teaching himself at the same time. So to me, that's just as magical, if not more, than a man showing up and producing a cello out of thin air.
And you're talking about teaching, and that is also a very important part of this book, The Spirit of Music, Victor Wooten. You are a teacher. You have music camps, and you have a kind of philosophy of teaching music embodied in your character, Michael. Tell us about that philosophy.
Sure, sure. It's so funny that, you know, it's become a method and a philosophy and all that. And really, it's just the way I think about it. I never thought of it as that deep. But when Bela Fleck and the Flecktones started becoming popular, I started showing up in magazines a lot, especially the bass magazines. And I found out that if you show up in those magazines enough, people think you're good, whether they've heard you or not, and they'll ask you to teach. So I started being asked to teach, and I had never taught anything. So I literally started researching teaching. What are musicians teaching? What are the best teachers teach? So I bought videos, bought books, and my opinion was everybody's teaching great stuff, but it's all centered around 12 notes. And I knew that music was more than 12 notes. Because my whole life, they've always told me that I was in the rhythm section. But there were no books and no teachers that I could find teaching me how to be in the rhythm section. They were just teaching me what notes to play. And I realized, again, like I said, nobody gets up to dance because the song is in the key of E flat. Right? They're dancing to something else. And that's how I grew up. We had to play dances. People wanted to move. So what else is there? Notes are important, yes. But I can buy the notes. When I bought my bass, when you buy your piano, you have the same notes as the greatest in the world. Doesn't matter how good you are, you don't get a new note. So what else is there? And I dissected that. And so I decided, I came up with a bunch of stuff, but I honed it down to 10 different parts of music. And notes is one of them. Notes is in there because they are important. They're just not all important as we teach it. So I looked at other things like tone and articulation and phrasing. You know, sometimes when I'm using a PowerPoint, I show a class, a group of rocks, just a pile of rocks. And I say, what is that? They say a pile of rocks. Then I show them another thing. It's just another pile of rocks, except they're beautifully organized. And I say, look at the difference. If you look at every individual rock, it's no more beautiful than the pile. But the organization, the phrasing, how we group things together makes it more meaningful. So that's so elegant and important. And when you learn how to phrase, basically when you learn all of these elements that I call elements of music, you realize I don't have to be as good as I thought I was, right? Willie Nelson doesn't know a whole lot of chords or music theory. I doubt he can read. But if he plays one chord, you stop everything to listen because it's real. Sometimes we allow our knowledge to get into the way of who we really are. And it's who you are that draws us to you and keeps us there. And that used to be the main criteria for being popular, is being original and good.
Well, that echoes something that Michael says in the book. He says he is the one who remembers who he is, and he remembers who he was, which allows him to remember who he will next be. What are you saying there?
And, you know, in many cases, I hate to say what I'm saying because I want people to do it their own way. But I will say this. My parents were very, very interested in us boys. Okay, you got to think of this, and I hope I don't offend anyone by saying this. I'm the youngest of five Black African-American boys born in the 50s and 60s. It was a different era in the world, especially America at that time for people of color. My parents were born in 30 and 34, totally different. They knew what we were facing as boys. And their main thing was for us to know who we were, because we were facing a country that didn't support who we were. So we had to know, because if you don't know who you are, you'll start believing what people tell you that you are or who you are. And our parents got rid of your opinion of me in my mind right away. In other words, I'll listen to your opinion, but I know that your opinion of me is your opinion of me, not mine. And we learned that very on. So we learned who we are. But my mom always said that you're a miracle, right? Because a baby born is a miracle. We can't really tell you how it happens. It's a miracle. Everyone, the fact that we each all have a fingerprint that's different than any human's ever been or ever will be, that's a miracle. That means you have the precious jewel that no one else in the world ever will have. You have the only one. What it took to be born is a miracle. Out of all the choices that could have been at that moment, some kind of way life chose you, right? So we're miracles. We forget that. We define ourselves by what we do, not who we are. So regardless of what I do, I'm still a miracle, whether I do anything or not. So to keep it safe, I only go back to that far as to who we were, that miracle that showed up at that moment, right? But it also allows, knowing who I am, allows me to decide who I want to be, right? What I want to do with this miracle is my choice. That's the cool thing of being human. We get choice. So, you know, we're doing an online camp for the second year in a row. Last year, it was called 2020 Vision for the Future. This year, it's 2021 Vision for the Future. And our slogan is, why predict the future when you can create it? And for those that know how to do it, and we all know how to do it, we just forget at times. Like, we wanted to learn to walk. We did it over and over. We fell. We didn't quit. Nobody was learning to walk and said, you know what? It's not for me. You know, mom pushed me in a stroller my whole life. I'm giving up. All right. So we have the will, how, the know-how, and the courage to do it, or not the courage. We can do it. We just have lost something.
Michael says he remembers who he will next be. Is that what you mean when you say we've lost something, that it's about remembering who we are?
Absolutely. Remembering means to put back together, to put together. That's what it really means. We think of it as, you know, as like the future hasn't happened yet, but you're putting it together from pieces that have happened, right? If I practice the guitar, I know I'm going to get good unless I quit. That's the key to any success. Just don't quit. It's really that simple, but it's also the key to failure is to quit. The key to success and the key to failure are identical. So yes, you can remember, you can put together who you will be next. And we do it all the time. You go to college to be a doctor, you know that if you go through all the years of college and doctor, you'll become a doctor. It's not rocket science. You just got to do it and not quit. So it sounds like magic, and it is magic, to be truthful. It is magic. But it's magic you know the secret to. It's not any less magic because you know the secret. You still got to do it. Whatever it is you want to be, just don't stop. And so that's why Michael can remember who he will next be, because that's what we're all doing anyway.
You say that musicians are music shamans, and I really feel so much of what we've been talking about already brings that idea out, that there is something magical, not in the sense of otherworldly, but in the sense of making something happen, like the tarot card, the magician. He's the one who creates.
Absolutely. Music is totally like that. Again, name something in the world that brings thousands of people together to agree, right? The people who don't agree aren't there. And once you're there, you will do whatever the person on stage asks. And you will, if you like what they did or said, you'll turn to a stranger next to you and high five and laugh. And what other power is it? It's not like religion where you have to believe in the same God as me. It's not like politics where you have to know who you voted for before you're allowed in. You know, it's not where I'm looking at the color of your skin. All that's gone. And you do music as you do it at your own will. It's powerful. I can play something that will make you move, guaranteed. And it'll make you move unconsciously, right? I know how to make you laugh, smile, think, question, wrinkle your forehead. I know how to do it. If you're clapping with me, I know how to musically make you stop. It's an invisible power that most people can't see it, but we know it's real. At that point, it's magic.
One question I have is, in this book, In the Spirit of Music, in the story, there are these malevolent beings, these men who are trying to kill music or trying to damage music or to take it out of the world, weaken it. And it's malevolence. It's intentional. Why that? Why is the death of music or the dying of music just something that's happening because of our inattention rather than something that is intentional?
Well, the phasers, as we call them in the book, is these people, entities, I don't know, really know what they are, but they are intentionally trying to diminish music. And I call them phasers because in real life, in music, when a signal is out of phase, the sound totally diminishes and sometimes disappears altogether. So I thought that was a cool name for the phasers. But again, this book is talking about music, but it's really talking a whole lot about a whole lot more. If we think about this, Francesca, right now I can go to the store and I can buy a liter or a 2-liter bottle of cola cheaper than I can buy an 8-ounce bottle of water. And we're used to that. We have become, as the book would say, phased. We think that's normal. We don't realize how preposterous that is, that we've been conditioned slowly but surely to think that's okay. Why is fast food cheaper than healthy food? Now, don't you think that someone had to make that decision? Or did it just happen on its own? When I was a kid, they taught us how to read by sounding out letters in the alphabet. A makes A. If you put a line over it, it makes the A sound. You learn B makes B. So once you learn that, you can read any word. But then I remember, because my mom pointed it out to us as kids, when it changed to what they call the look-see method. In other words, you show the word cat and you show a picture of a cat. So the kid learns to recognize cat. But if you put a B as the first letter, they can't read bat. So all of a sudden, Hooked on Phonics became an after-school program that your parents had to buy. Why do we have to buy the thing that teaches us how to read? Isn't what school is about? So there's been tons of studies that show that kids who learn music, or anyone that learns music, especially at an early age, all the benefits that you have in life, right? There haven't been any studies that I know of that show that playing football makes you better at math. Nothing against football. I love it. But the studies have shown where music, which is really math, makes you better at math. So why is it taken out of schools? These are decisions somebody's making. So same with music. So I use music, but I'm really talking about a whole lot of things. To me, we are being phased. By who and for what reason should be looked at?
Yes, yes. And I want to say this has just been such an inspirational conversation and a thought-provoking conversation. Victor Wooten, as is this book, The Spirit of Music, thank you so much for talking with Writer's Voice about this wonderful book.
Francesca, I'm honored, and I mean it truthfully and deeply. You know, for any of us writers or musicians, we really owe a lot to people like you who help put our voice out there, because we love what we do and we would do it anyway. But you all are the people that really make people know us. So we thank you for that.
Victor Wooten. Go to writersvoice.net for a link to read an excerpt from The Spirit of Music. Next up, how the American middle class was created and why it's withering away. Stay tuned after the break. Victor Wooten improvising on Amazing Grace at a performance of Bella Fleck and the Flecktones. The 1950s and 60s was the high point of the American middle class, but the prosperity didn't extend to everyone. With its roots in the New Deal, the building of the middle class depended on political calculations that left out people of color and single women. In his new book, The Promised Land, David Steben explains how the American middle class ballooned at mid-century, shows who it benefited and why, and what brought the expansion to an end. David Steben is professor of history and law at Ohio State University. David Steben, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thanks for having me.
This book, Promised Land, is very interesting because I lived through this period. I was a kid in the 50s and, you know, went off to college in the 60s. You know, I lived through stagflation. I saw the destruction, the erosion, let's say, of the American middle class. And, you know, I've always had a sense of what the broad outlines as to why that happened. But your book really goes into it in far more detail. And unlike the popular myth, you say that the U.S. was actually never a dominantly middle-class country until the 1930s to the 1960s, that 30-year period. Tell us more about that.
Well, at the founding of the country, the U.S. was a very varied place. So if we're talking about Pennsylvania, it did have a great big middle class that was basically rural at the founding. But Virginia and South Carolina were different and so on. As a national or almost national phenomenon that encompassed a solid majority of the population, the USA doesn't really get to that point of having a majority middle class society until the middle third of the 20th century, in part because farming declined. And then factories replaced farms for many people. But for a long time, wages in factories were low for most workers. And so as recently as the most prosperous years of the mid to late 1920s, roughly half of the U.S. population lived below the poverty line or close to it.
Rapidly getting there again with, 60% don't have $400 to spend, in an emergency.
You're exactly right. The current parallel analogy to that situation in the 20s, income and wealth distribution have returned to what they were like in the mid to late 20s. And so roughly half of all American households have a net worth of zero or less. So some things are different now, but in terms of economic insecurity, we're sort of back to where we were almost before the 1930s and 40s changed things.
A lot of times people say, the American middle class, but they're really talking about a particular slice of the population, not economically middle slice of the population. They're talking about a kind of racial slice.
Right. Well, and you must keep in mind that when this story opens, my book deals with the period from 1929 to 1968. And according to the 1930 census, roughly 80% of all African Americans lived in the South. And the South was by far the poorest and most rural part of the country at that time. And so it is indisputably true that when the middle class rose in a big way, beginning in the later 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s, it was a disproportionately white group. There were African Americans in it, most famously, Martin Luther King Jr. and his family. They were never rich. They were never poor. They were middle class. But it was a very heavily white group. And Francesca, the one other thing that sort of complicates this story is that when it opens in the late 1920s, the notion of who was white was more limited than it is today. And so people from Southern and Eastern Europe, Italian Americans, for example, were viewed as a group not quite white in the 1920s by many white people of Northern and Western European ancestry. So by the 1960s, Italian Americans have become white. So there's a kind of ambiguity in that term as well. In other words, the fraction of the population that could be thought of as white grows, and the middle class grows as well.
Yes, and I remember growing up Jewish in the 1950s with you know, there was country clubs Jews could not belong to, even if they were in the upper class. So, you know, the Jews were also not seen as entirely white. But the three Americas you talk about, tell us about what are the three Americas, and then tell us about America's three main geographical regions.
Right. If you're talking about major population groups, and I think that's the way I use it in the book, the three Americas refers to three different groups. There are Americans of Northern and Western European ancestry, and they're white, and they're the largest fraction of the population as a group. They're almost exactly half in 1930 when this story basically opens. And they are partly urban, partly rural, partly suburban. They're the part of the population that's seemingly everywhere. And they are the, and have been the dominant group from the founding. And one of the striking things about how much has changed since the early 1930s is that the American establishment, whether you're talking corporate boardrooms or country clubs or university presidents, is overwhelmingly, almost entirely composed of people like that. So, and the assumption of the people in that group is that this is what America is going to be like as a whole. In other words, that the other kinds of folks in the society are going to assimilate into that, right? So there's the first America. The second America is a group basically added in the later 19th century through about 1920 in terms of immigration. There, some are of Irish ancestry, but the bulk are from Southern and Eastern Europe. And they're theologically somewhat different. They tend to be much more Catholic or Jewish than Protestant. And they are overwhelmingly, in the time that I'm writing about, major metropolitan. In 1930, they're mostly urban, and then they become urban and suburban. And so they're a distinct world. And then there's the third America in terms of numbers and political influence, although not in terms of length of tenure in the country, and that's African Americans, right? And they're about 13% of the overall population as this story opens. Historically, they've been predominantly Southerners, and that's still true in 1930. And they, you know, they've been part of the American story from the very beginning. And there are some African Americans who have achieved distinction in American life and been recognized by the wider culture. So the, you know, the jazz age of the 1920s, the greatest star it produces is Louis Armstrong. So, and people in the music world and jazz know, they know who he is. He's a kind of national figure for jazz musicians. But the point is, they are a much less visible and influential group in many ways than either the folks in the Second America or the First.
Yeah, and this is very much a theme in terms of the creation of the middle class. Talk about Roosevelt's New Deal as a creator of the white middle class, and how the creation of the middle class, i.e. the white middle class, actually increased division, increased segregation, you could say, outside of the South, which was already segregated, leading to a middle class culture that was more conformist and more racist than it had been before the middle class had been created.
Well, one of the paradoxical things about the Great Depression is that it makes the Democratic Party, which had been the B team of American politics since the Civil War, the dominant one, almost overnight. And the Democratic Party of the 1930s had two main parts. It had the big cities of the North, and it had the solid white segregationist South. And so to put the Democrats in charge in the 30s, and they are mostly in charge from the 30s through the 1960s, is to give the Southern segregationists a lot more clout in American life. And even though Roosevelt himself and most of the advisors around him are urban Northerners and distinctly more liberal, as that term is now understood, than Southern Democrats. So, but Roosevelt is dependent on Southern Democrats to get his legislation passed, in part because most of the most senior people in Congress are Southerners, because they have almost unbroken 30-year careers there, because the South in those days was a one-party region run by the Democrats. So that you create this odd situation in which the Democrats are a bipolar party in that era. The urban North, which is the most liberal part of the country, and the white segregationist dominated South, in which very few Black people are voters. And so Roosevelt does go about trying to rescue much of the middle class. In other words, there are a lot of people in the middle of the economic spectrum who fall into the ranks of the poor as a result of the Great Depression, and a whole lot of others who fear that they might. They come close to that. And the people who like him the most, typically, Franklin Roosevelt and his programs, tend to be people who feel rescued by the New Deal. And African Americans do better in important ways. In other words, it is not a myth. And the clearest sign of that is that historically they have, to the extent they could vote at all, they preferred Republicans. But it's in the 30s that the bulk of the Black community in this country becomes Democrats, something that remains true. And the single most important thing that Roosevelt does, and the people around him, to bring about that change, is they agree to the creation of federal relief programs for the unemployed. And that is a very big deal in terms of survival for African Americans living on the very brink of disaster in the 1930s. So, but most of those African Americans don't get into the middle class, right? And so are they better off than they were before when they faced the prospect of mass starvation? Yes. But do they participate fully and equally in the rise of the middle class? They do not, right? And so it's a complicated story.
This is Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking with David Steben about his book, Promised Land, How the Rise of the Middle Class Transformed America. We know about the post-war Levittown, which was totally white development, but even FDR's, Tennessee Valley Authority, which brought electrification to a huge swath of the country, did not include the Black population. Explain that. I mean, that his redlining actually began under the New Deal.
Right. All of these things you're saying are exactly right, but the reasons for them are somewhat different. In other words, in the case of the Tennessee Valley Authority, Tennessee is the South. And as that project is built in the South in the 30s, Roosevelt opts to work through the existing political power structure of the region, which means that Southern segregationist senators and congressmen have a lot of clout in determining who gets hired to build all those hydroelectric dams that electrify a very poor region, right? And so you are quite correct. African Americans are mostly excluded from being employed by TVA, as big a project as it is. And to the extent they get jobs at all, they tend to be the lowest level kinds of jobs, the dirtiest jobs and the least well-paid ones. And then there's the housing industry. In other words, in the 1930s, as the Depression unfolds, there is a foreclosure crisis. And it's partly a farm foreclosure crisis because there are so many more family farms in those days, but there is also a housing crisis. And when the New Deal steps in to rescue people whose homes are threatened with foreclosure because all of a sudden they have no income and no ability to get a job, the New Deal solution is to take the existing system of mortgages, which existed in the 20s and so on. And mortgages in those days were strange things. They tended to be much shorter term than today. They tended to have a balloon payment at the end. They didn't really work well, except for people in the top fifth of the income distribution. So what does Franklin Roosevelt do that makes most people in the middle three-fifths ultimately homeowners, at least for a while? The idea is to create the so-called 30-year fixed mortgage, equal monthly payments over a 30-year period, with the federal government often stepping in to guarantee that the money will be repaid, so bankers are willing to lend to people who aren't affluent. But what does that mean? In order to be a good risk for a 30-year mortgage, you have to have a stable middle-class job for 30 years. And that very much tilts the playing field against most African Americans, whose place in the job market tends not to be that. Oh, there are some upper-class Black people in the 1930s and some middle-class ones, but most Black people tend to be towards the bottom of the income-earning population and have the lowest paid jobs and the like. And so they don't get to participate much in the New Deal Revolution in housing. But white Americans, including many people who are basically working class and living in cities and living in apartments in the 30s, they do after World War II, when mass suburbia arises. And this is where I would say, Francesca, if there's one thing more than anything else that helps make America more segregated in the middle class era, it's the rise of mass suburbia. Because through 1968, it's an almost entirely white mode of residence. I mean, one way of talking about segregation is to focus on laws, the Jim Crow system and all that. Another is sort of de facto. Is there a lot of space between Black and white people? And one of the consequences of mass suburbia in the 25 or so years after World War II is it means that many more white people live in suburbs that are essentially all white, including the first Levittown. And so in a way, Supreme Court decisions and eventually federal laws desegregate the country in some ways. But through about 1970, in terms of where people live, the amount of racial segregation is actually growing for the reasons I've mentioned.
Now, one way in which at least some Black people were able to achieve a middle class, to join the middle class, was because of industrial unionism. So the National Labor Relations Act was passed by FDR. You know, Kennedy, who was, you know, not exactly a radical unionist, but he greatly expanded the public sector unions. So talk about unionization as a key element. And let's not forget, of course, the role of workers themselves in bringing about this industrial union movement, but just in the sense of national policy, allowing it to go forward.
Right. In the 1930s, a lot of workers want to join unions. And so there's this upsurge in organizing by ordinary workers. And there also are a lot of committed activists, many of them very left-wing in the labor movement, who want to organize these workers. And then there's a government response from above, from state governors who are New Dealers and from the Roosevelt administration to pass laws that make that happen. Now, the question is whether African-Americans will get into these newly emerging unions and benefit from the higher wages and benefits and all the like. And the labor movement has varied on that. The Auto Workers Union and the Steel Workers Union are the two biggest new industrial unions of the 30s, 40s, and 50s. And a significant Black presence emerges in both. And so if you are fortunate enough to be a working class Black person who's an auto worker or a steel worker and you're in the union, you move up economically. And you, in some sense, become middle class. But what you won't be through the end of the 1960s is suburban, right? In other words, they tend, if you're working in a factory town or a city like Detroit in an auto plant, you tend to stay within the city limits in an urban neighborhood. So you may buy a small house and so on because you're paid a union wage and all the rest. But your experience with this era is different. Right. And so the middle class experience is not an entirely unified one because there are middle class Black people and there are more of them by the 1960s than there used to be. But the bulk of the middle class of this era is white. And if you look at the advertising and the imagery on TV of the era, say when you were growing up in the 50s and 60s, right, it's overwhelmingly white. So it does help create a kind of more uniform American public culture, but by today's standards, it's stunningly undiverse. So what's the good news from the point of view of middle-class people of all kinds? More of what's on radio and television is about people like them, in some sense. And what's the bad news, if you're a minority group member, is they don't literally look like you. And there are some Black people on TV, but they tend not to be depicted as middle-class homeowners. They tend to be depicted in these low-end service jobs that many African-Americans historically held. So it's a complicated picture. You can see why there'd be much more nostalgia for this era among middle-class white people than within the Black community.
So, you know, it's interesting because this is a very racially segregated picture of a middle class. And yet we have other countries in the world, in the advanced democracies, which are currently predominantly middle class, and post-war became that way, without that kind of racial overtones. And they have been able to keep more of, you know, a larger segment of their population in that with that kind of middle class stability. There have been many supports for that in this country that eroded. You know, they're all part of an international global capitalist system, but they've made some different choices. You point to economic issues like price inflation, automation, and the revival of foreign competition as Europe recovered post-war as the causes of the erosion of prosperity in the manufacturing sector in the U.S. Now, that had some really important impacts. Talk about them. Talk about stagflation and talk about the erosion of the assault, the growing assault on unions.
Right. And again, the focus of the book is the rise. I'm actually now starting work on a sequel that'll be about the decline since about 1970. But I do talk about the roots of the decline. You know, the growth of the middle class slows in the mid to late 1960s. And what you're alluding to is one key reason. In other words, one of the funny things about the U.S. is unions become strong in the period from the 1930s through the 1950s, when the U.S. has very little in the way of effective foreign competition. And that's partly because trade barriers are higher than tariffs, and also because as a result of World War II, the industrial plant of Western Europe and East Asia is very heavily damaged. And so it's possible for American workers to become the best paid factory workers in the world by the mid-1950s without causing much of a problem in terms of foreign competition based on lower wages. But as the new factories constructed after World War II come online in Western Europe and East Asia, most notably Japan and South Korea, by the 1960s, foreign competition is brewing. And then there's a real problem because the United States is committed to lowering trade barriers, to fostering a healthier world market system, in part because they need allies in the Cold War, so they want Western Europe to become stable and prosperous, and the same for East Asia. And so it becomes harder and harder to sustain those high wages and great benefits in the manufacturing sector. And that's not the only way to get to the middle class in a period I write about from the 30s through the 60s, but it's one key way. The other way is if you're sort of lower middle class in a white collar job, often employed in the public sector because government grows a lot in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, and those jobs are less menaced by foreign competition. But the blue collar part, to use an old fashioned phrase, of the new middle class is increasingly struggling by the mid to late 1960s.
You know, what strikes me, what's key is that the manufacturing sector, we all saw it, you know, the jobs went south or they got offshore to other countries, which really it destroyed the union movement and manufacturing in this country. That's what hasn't happened in the European countries that have maintained more of a middle class than we have. Their unions are still strong. Why did it happen differently there than it did here?
One crucial advantage the Europeans have is that the Americans go first and they learn from America's mistakes, if that makes sense. So do they see that wages can go so high as to make entire sectors of the economy vulnerable? They do. So what is it the Europeans do that helps keep overall labor costs lower in their factory world? The governments of Western Europe typically take on the responsibility of social insurance, healthcare, and the like, which is a very expensive thing for a lot of American employers by the 1960s. Because, of course, in the United States, health insurance is primarily for families done through employers, for example. So if you're in the steel industry or the auto industry, you aren't just paying the workers high wages, you're also providing for these benefits, especially the ever more expensive healthcare ones. And that just doesn't exist in Western Europe. In other words, the government does that. through taxation. And so the Europeans also choose to structure their welfare state programs, for lack of a better term, in a different way. By the way, it does eventually catch up with the Europeans. In other words, if you sat down with a group of a representative group of Western Europeans now, what they tell you is slowly but surely ever more of their heavy industry is moving southward and out of Europe. And so we just had an election in Germany, and the pollsters there have been asking a whole lot of questions of the German electorate. And one of the things they're most worried about is that over the next 10 years, a lot of really good factory jobs in Germany are going to disappear. So to a degree, what's going on is a process that's finally arriving in places like Western Europe and Japan and Korea, that because the Americans started this, they're farther along on the timeline.
One thing that I think you make a very important point about is the role of military spending in the creation of the American middle class. I mean, as you point out, you know, the Great Depression, despite all the social programs that were done by the New Deal, you know, went back into a depression in 1936 to 1938. The war got us out of that. And one could even argue that military spending, you know, was what has juiced this economy even since World War II. So I'd like you to talk about that. But then also, I think a point that I didn't see in your book was how military spending itself is a key inflationary type of spending, as opposed to more social insurance type of spending. And you point to inflation as being a problem. I'm wondering why you don't identify military spending as a key aspect of that inflationary spending.
Right. Well, inflation remains very much under control in this country most of the time, except after the mid-1960s. And I think the book does make the point that President Johnson's decision to go into the Vietnam War in a big way is ultimately quite inflationary. But there are lots of factors at work here. Even the term military spending is somewhat ambiguous because, as the book points out, there are different ways you can wage wars. And World War II in particular is waged in a New Deal-ish kind of way. 16 million people serve, mostly men, but not entirely. And they're paid high wages for their service compared with all the other major combatants. And so it's one of the best compensated fighting forces in the history of the world. And the compensation doesn't stop when the war is over. In other words, the benefits paid to veterans of World War II through the GI Bill are really very generous. And that does a lot to help create the middle class, because of course there's a subsidy for home ownership, college is paid for if you want to get more formal education, money from the federal government if you're a veteran to start a small business. And so that kind of military spending is more like social spending. It's spending on people, right? And arguably that is decisive in the 40s and 50s to making the great big middle class. The part of military spending that bothers most people the most is piling up huge numbers of weapons. And that seems a more sterile kind of investment, right? You're creating ever more powerful weapons that you fervently hope never get used by anyone, right? And so there is sort of weapons production, enormous weapons production during World War II and afterwards. And that comes under increasing criticism. But the point is the single biggest part of military spending in the era I write about is people. Now, in the more recent past, since September 11th, 2001, to the extent the military has been fighting since then, it has not been fighting in a New Deal-ish kind of way. Taxes on the affluent did not rise in order to pay for the war effort. The burden of military service has not been broadly shared. So, but in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, those things are different, right? And so the tax structure of the New Deal and the war, which stays in place through the mid-1960s, does a lot to bring up the middle and bring down the top, narrowing the gap between those two groups.
Yes, that's very important. Progressive taxation. I mean, we saw something up to 90% on the top under Eisenhower, of all people, who was a Republican. You end this book, David Stebbin, you end Promised Land with a thesis that one can take the trend toward expanding the middle class too far. And I want to kind of push back on, I mean, you say that because wages, kind of the inflationary pressure, and then profits are squeezed as workers gain more power and more of the pie. And so capital goes looking for cheaper labor, et cetera. But couldn't one say that that is, it's basically within the capitalist framework, maximizing profit and maximizing social welfare are not particularly compatible under this, but under a different kind of system where, you know, there could be controls on profit, where, let's say, people's welfare maximization is at least as important as profit maximization, different choices could be made, and you could have a larger middle class without running into those kinds of inflationary pressures. What do you say to that?
It is theoretically possible. I agree with you. The question is sort of, given what this country is like, is that a realistic objective, right? Especially in the era I write about. I'm not writing about today. I'm writing about the period of the 1930s through the 60s. There are more radical visions and voices in the 1930s, but the people who try to make a better market system, a new and improved one, tend to be the dominant voices. Right, and there are more conservative people than that. The people who want to sort of transform the system along the lines you're suggesting are never anything like a majority of the population. Right, and one of the most disturbing things about this system is the longer it goes on, the more moderate voices drown out all the others, right, including those on the far left. And so there's a point I'm making about going too far is the middle class has its own set of priorities. And it increasingly, the system by the early 1960s is very responsive to them, but they aren't the only people there are. And the system is not very responsive to other kinds of people and priorities. And within that middle class world, by the way, it's very much a male breadwinner model. And so one of the most troubling things from today's vantage point about this era, which we haven't really talked about, is how male-dominated it becomes. With the longer the middle class is rising, seemingly the more male-dominated it is. And not everything about that is positive, right? And so it's partly a cautionary tale. Be careful what you wish for. You just might get it. But there's also a point. Middle-class people, if they live in middle-class suburbia, are isolated both from the rich and the poor. And both groups, at least in theory, can make useful contributions to society. So above and below, not just in between. So it's not an easy thing. I think the language I use in the book is not everything that works well for the middle class in the short run works so well for them over the longer term or for other kinds of people. Right? And I think even most middle class people would agree.
Yeah, or at least for that middle class that you're talking about. And I was looking from the perspective of a time here, you know, we can talk about late stage capitalism where, you know, less and less is the economy working for anybody except the 0.1% at the top, and where a few just really 70 some corporations are killing the planet. Talking about, you know, what's good for everybody, more and more people are seeing this system is really not working. So, you know, I think what's so valuable about your book, David Stebbin, is to think about what would work to raise all boats. What would it mean to have a truly middle-class society where people have enough? Not too much, not too little. They have enough, and it's sustainable for the planet as well. What might be some of your last thoughts on that?
And it's a great question. And it's one of the most important reasons why I wrote the book. In other words, I decided to make the focus of the book, the rise of the middle class. I was writing a history of this general era, but I decided to focus on the rise of the middle class because there was this debate in 2016 when Donald Trump ran for the presidency about what that era was like. And what we ended up from him was this overly positive view when America was great. And then a lot of books about the era that pointed out all the flaws and that were somewhat unbalanced in the other direction. And I think you're exactly right. What the public conversation that's going on now is sort of, what would a new and improved version of a predominantly middle-class country look like? And so I thought, I will write this book. And it is primarily intended for educated general readers for that reason. It's available in all formats. There's hardback, paperback. If you're a listener, there's an audiobook. They're all priced in a very middle-class kind of way to maximize accessibility. And you can get it at Amazon or bookstores, wherever books are sold. But the point is, if you sit down and have some perspective, which I hope the book provides, on what the previous middle-class era is like, it's not that hard to start making a list of what a new and improved middle-class era would look like. Would it be more flexible with respect to gender roles and gender relations? Yes. Would it be more inclusive of people who aren't white? Absolutely. Would it be more tolerant of people who, for whatever reason, don't really fit into middle-class ways of living? And we'll always have some folks like that. Yes, it would be more tolerant of them. When people ask me for a very concrete example of how it would be new and improved, my personal favorite has to do with cigarettes. As the middle class rose in the period I wrote about, they smoked ever more cigarettes. This was a public health problem and so on. And so what would a new and improved version be? A non-smoking version. One in which you have millions of middle-class people who are not puffing away on cigarettes seemingly everywhere. And so if you think of it in those terms, and by the way, this is utterly central to the national political debate today. President Biden is an intriguing figure. Why? Because he grew up in the era that I wrote about as a middle-class person. In other words, he was born in 1942, and as the middle class rose, he rose with it. And his nickname for his 36 years in the U.S. Senate, given to him, sort of a put-down, I think, from the other members of the Senate, was Middle Class Joe. And so he is very focused. I think he probably thinks more about how to make the middle class bigger again than anything else. And so, of course, we have pending in Congress now infrastructure, you know, ways to strengthen the system that would employ people who don't necessarily have a ton of formal education, but want to make good middle-class incomes, and then building and changing things in a way that is conducive to expanding the middle class. So it's very much a contemporary debate, and my hope is that the book sort of helps make for a more thoughtful discussion about how best to do it.
And the book is Promised Land, How the Rise of the Middle Class Transformed America, 1929 to 1968. David Stevin, it's been really interesting to talk with you today about this book. Thank you. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.